Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, let's start right up with the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all the wonderful things in the world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, from Healthline, alcohol-related deaths have doubled since 1999. Here's why. A new study finds that the number of alcohol-related deaths per year among people ages 16 and older doubled from 35,900 to 72,600 between 1999 and 2017. Researchers found that in 2017, nearly 3% of roughly 3 million U.S. deaths involved alcohol. Nearly half of those deaths were caused by liver disease or overdosing on alcohol alone or in addition to other drugs. Rates were highest among men, people between 45 and 74 years old, and among non-Hispanic American Indians or Alaska Natives. Given previous reports that death certificates often fail to indicate the contribution of alcohol, the scope of alcohol-related mortality in the United States is likely higher than suggested from death certificates alone. Findings confirm an increased burden of alcohol on public health and support the need for improving surveillance of alcohol-involved mortality. The study reveals that trends in alcohol use are different for men than for women. Researchers found the overall prevalence of drinking and binge drinking didn't change for men. Among women, there was a 10% increase in the prevalence of drinking and an almost 25% increase in binge drinking. People 50 and older also increased alcohol consumption more compared to younger age groups. It is important to recognize what alcohol is. Alcohol is effectively, in many ways, an anesthetic. Alcohol makes you feel less, not more, said Alex Demetrio of Menlo Park Psychiatry and Sleep Medicine. The question then becomes, what is it we're trying to anesthetize? Because I think that these rising rates of alcohol-related deaths and binge drinking are really evidence of a society that perhaps is trying to mask, hide, or run away from something, he said. According to the study, rates of emergency department visits that involve alcohol increased almost 50% among people aged 12 and older. Alcohol-related emergency department visits and hospitalizations were significantly greater for females than males and even more evident in older age groups. Women are continually increasing in their use of alcohol, catching up to men. Alcohol use among women is not only increasing, but the openness to it is increasing as well, said Mo Gelbart, PhD, a psychologist at Gelbart & Associates. Between 2000 and 2015, the rates of deaths from alcohol-related liver damage, or cirrhosis, in the United States increased 35%, with the number of deaths about 74% higher, according to recently published research. However, the full magnitude of alcohol-related mortality in the United States is difficult to determine, in part because the contribution of alcohol is not always apparent at the time that a death certificate is completed. Some research indicates that death certificates can often fail to record the contribution of drinking to the cause of death. One study found fewer than 20% of drunk driving fatalities were recorded as alcohol-related on death certificates. An estimated 88,000 people die from alcohol-related causes annually, making alcohol the third leading preventable cause of death in the United States. In 2014, alcohol-related driving deaths accounted for nearly 10,000 deaths, or 31% of overall driving fatalities. Another factor is that, like with many other diseases, there's better reporting. Deaths which were not attributed to alcohol-related illnesses in the past are being recognized more. We also know that suicide is greatly on the rise, and alcohol is a huge factor in suicide rates. He added, "I'm not surprised that there's an increase in deaths and an increase in alcohol use in general." Demetrio emphasized that it looks like people are in distress. He explained that conditions like depression, anxiety, and insomnia, while being physical issues, can also result from a disconnect from essential functions like off time, friends, family, and love. Okay, next up from Science Daily. 40% of gun owners reported not locking all guns, even around kids. While waiting for free firearm storage devices at gun safety events held in sporting goods stores across Washington, nearly 3,000 people filled out a one-page survey asking how they stored guns at home and other household information. While the participants reported emphasized the need for these public gun safety events, Seattle Children's and the University of Washington researchers say, because 40% of gun owners at the events reported having at least one firearm in their home that was not locked up. In addition, 39% of survey takers indicated they kept a loaded gun at home, and 14% stored all guns unlocked and loaded. Even in this population, which clearly has some interest in or awareness of firearm safety, there was a high prevalence of unlocked firearms, said lead author Aisha King, who worked on the study while a graduate student at the University of Washington School of Public Health. Furthermore, result of surveys conducted at the events in 10 Washington cities between 2015 and 2018 determined that the presence of children in the home did not make a difference. Public gun safety events are an effective tool for improving the safety of kids living around firearms, a previous study found, and the events reach an important audience, male gun owners. This is an important demographic to reach, King said, because men make up the majority of gun owners and typically take responsibility for how guns are stored in the home. When gun safety interventions are held in pediatricians' offices or similar clinic settings, most parents or guardians who attend are female. Storing firearms locked and unloaded, the research point out, is associated with a greater than 70% reduction in risk of unintentional and self-inflicted firearm injuries among young people. When it comes to firearm storage, some adults might think that younger children don't know where the guns are or don't know how to access them, but that is not always the case. A lot of times the kids do know. Also, guardians might think that training adolescents or older children is enough to keep them safe. That training doesn't mean they don't have to lock their guns. Unfortunately, a lot of adolescents are at high risk of suicide, and unlocked guns add greatly to that risk, regardless of training. Okay, moving on. This from the Washington Post. Coca-Cola internal documents reveal efforts to sell to teens despite obesity crisis. A new paper in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health found that the Coca-Cola company's public relations goals included trying to shift teens' sense of the health impacts of drinking sugary soda. Obesity rates for children have tripled since the 1970s, an increase that puts children at greater risk of diabetes, heart disease, and other health problems. The 2015 to 2016 National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey found 18.5% of kids ages 2 to 19 were obese. In the United States, childhood obesity is estimated to cost $14 billion annually in direct health expenses. Countries such as Mexico, Chile, and Brazil have pushed back against sugary sodas legislatively, enacting sugary drink taxes and limiting marketing and advertising directly to kids. Gary Ruskin, co-director of U.S. Right to Know, says after reviewing thousands of pages of requested documents from Coca-Cola, some themes emerge. One of these is Coca-Cola's effort to evade responsibility for the global obesity epidemic. Even though the health problems are quite severe in the U.S., we live under de facto corporate control. The food industry is incredibly powerful in the U.S. What's insidious here is a health campaign that is using tobacco's tactics, promoting alternative science in a way that advances the notion that sugary sodas aren't really so bad for people's health. Ruskin says Coca-Cola is intentionally targeting a vulnerable population. Ruskin points to Coca-Cola's powerful and far-reaching political apparatus as an impediment to enacting good sugary drink policy. There's a global effort from policymakers and public health people across the world trying to grasp the effect of ultra-processed food on human health, he said. It's a weapon of mass destruction. Okay, sticking with the obesity theme, this from CNN. Half of America will be obese within 10 years, study says, unless we work together. If America does not collectively adopt healthier eating habits, over half of the nation will be obese within 10 years. Even worse, 1 in 4 Americans will be severely obese with a body mass index over 35, which means it will be more than 100 pounds overweight. The world will have more than 250 million obese kids by 2030, a new report warns. That alarming prediction published in the New England Journal of Medicine was a result of a study analyzing self-reported body mass index data from over 6 million American adults. Currently, only 18% of all Americans are severely obese. If the trend continues, the study said, severe obesity would become as prevalent as overall obesity was in the 1990s. The study also found certain subpopulations to be at most risk for severe obesity: women, non-Hispanic black adults, and low-income adults who make less than $50,000 per year. 50 years ago, obesity was a relatively rare condition. People who were poor were underweight, not overweight, but that has changed. One reason is the rise of sugar-sweetened beverages and ultra-processed foods, which contribute calories but little nutrition. Another is that the price of food, including unhealthy fast food choices, has fallen in America when you adjust for inflation. Low food prices are certainly part of it. Also, limited options for physical activity. And there's a lot being written about the stress of structural racism and how that influences people's behavioral patterns. So it's very complicated. Studies have shown some promising tactics: bolstering local public transportation systems to encourage walking instead of driving, keeping schools open on weekends and during summers to allow access to gyms and swimming pools, and increasing support to farm-to-school and farm-to-work food programs, as well as farmers markets, to boost access to low-cost fruits and vegetables. Other interventions include calorie labeling on restaurant and drive-thru menus, and replacing vending machines with smart snacks in schools. We've also looked at eliminating the tax deduction businesses get for advertising unhealthy foods to children. The money that they spend on advertising foods can basically be written off as a tax deduction. That would be one reason why we see such disparity by race, ethnicity, or income, because companies are directly targeting advertising at these groups. Black and Hispanic youth are targeted with junk food ads, research shows. The most cost-effective solution was the tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. The study found the tax saved $30 in healthcare costs for every dollar spent on the program. So much added sugar is delivered through sugar-sweetened beverages, and people do have other options for hydration. I think it's an easy target, but not necessarily a popular one. Still, the complexity of the problem means that a solution will truly take a village, experts say, with every American doing their part. Okay, still sticking with the obesity theme, moving worldwide here from the World Health Organization. More than 1 in 3 low- and middle-income countries face both extremes of malnutrition. A new approach is needed to help reduce undernutrition and obesity at the same time, as the issues become increasingly connected due to rapid changes in countries' food systems. This is especially important in low- and middle-income countries, according to a new 4-paper report published in The Lancet. More than a third of such countries had overlapping forms of malnutrition, 45 of 123 countries in the 1990s and 48 of 126 countries in the 2010s, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, and East Asia, and the Pacific. Undernutrition and obesity can lead to effects across generations, as both maternal undernutrition and obesity are associated with poor health in offspring. However, because of the speed of change in food systems, more people are being exposed to both forms of malnutrition at different points in their lifetime, which further increases harmful health effects. We are facing a new nutrition reality, said lead author of the report, Dr. Francesco Branca, director of the Department of Nutrition for Health and Development of the World Health Organization. We can no longer characterize countries as low income and undernourished, or high income and only concerned with obesity. All forms of malnutrition have a common denominator: food systems that fail to provide all people with healthy, safe, affordable, and sustainable diets. Changing this will require action across food systems, from production and processing through trade and distribution, pricing, marketing, and labeling to consumption and waste. All relevant policies and investments must be radically reexamined. High-quality diets reduce the risk of malnutrition in all its forms by promoting healthy growth, development, and immunity, and preventing obesity and non-communicable diseases throughout life. The components of healthy diets are optimal breastfeeding practices in the first 2 years, a diversity and abundance of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, fiber, nuts, and seeds, modest amounts of animal source foods, minimal amounts of processed foods, and minimal amounts of foods and beverages high in energy and added amounts of sugar, saturated fats, trans fats, and salt. Emerging malnutrition issues are a stark indicator of the people who are not protected from the factors that drive poor diets. The poorest, low, and middle-income countries are seeing a rapid transformation in the way people eat, drink, and move at work, home, and in transport, and in leisure, said report author Professor Barry Popkin, University of North Carolina. The new nutrition reality is driven by changes to the food system, which have increased availability of ultra-processed foods that are linked to increased weight gain, while also adversely affecting infant and preschooler diets. These changes include disappearing fresh food markets, increasing supermarkets, and the control of the food chain by supermarkets, and global food catering and agriculture companies in many countries. Exposure to undernutrition early in life, followed by becoming overweight from childhood onward, increases the risk of a range of non-communicable diseases, making the double burden of malnutrition a key factor driving the emerging global epidemics of type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, stroke, and cardiovascular disease. Negative effects can also pass across generations. For example, the effect of maternal obesity on the likelihood of a child having obesity may be exacerbated if the mother was undernourished in early life. The report identifies a set of double duty actions that simultaneously prevent or reduce the risk of nutritional deficiencies leading to underweight, wasting, stunting, or micronutrient deficiencies and obesity or non-communicable diseases with the same intervention, program, or policy. These range from improved antenatal care and breastfeeding practices to social welfare and to new agricultural and food system policies with healthy diets as their primary goal. Okay, this from The Hill. Study: Medicaid expansion linked to 6% decline in opioid overdose deaths. Medicaid expansion was linked to a 6% reduction in opioid overdose deaths, according to a new study. The study finds the data indicates that Medicaid expansion may have prevented between 1,678 and 8,132 deaths from opioid overdoses between 2015 and 2017. For comparison, there were 82,000 total opioid overdose deaths in that time period. These findings add to the emerging body of evidence that Medicaid expansion under the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, may be a critical component of state efforts to address the continuing opioid overdose epidemic in the United States. Okay, sticking with the U.S. healthcare system, this from Physicians for a National Health Program. A paper published in the Annals of Internal Medicine shed light on the cost of bureaucratic waste in our healthcare financing system. This waste is a cost of enforcing unequal access to care and extracting profit. Healthcare bureaucracy cost Americans $812 billion in 2017, more than one-third, 34.2%, of total expenditures for doctor visits, hospitals, long-term care, and health insurance. A single-payer system would have saved the U.S. more than $600 billion in administrative expenditures in 2017 alone. Americans spend twice as much per person as Canadians for our health system. In return, we get extraordinary corporate profits, eight-figure executive salaries, and mountains of insurance paperwork. By switching to single-payer Medicare for All, we could redirect $600 billion per year in administrative costs towards patient care, enough to cover everyone for all medically necessary care without copays or deductibles. We cannot achieve this result from incremental reforms like a public option. Only Medicare for All has the power to reduce health spending and improve health outcomes. Hopefully that'll be good news for the upcoming future here. Not too far away, hopefully. Okay, sticking to this same theme. From the Washington Post, every American family basically pays an $8,000 poll tax under the U.S. health system, top economists say. America's sky-high healthcare costs are so far above what people pay in other countries that they are equivalent to a hefty tax, Princeton University economists Ann Case and Angus Deaton say. They are surprised Americans aren't revolting against these taxes. A few people are getting very rich at the expense of the rest of us, Case said at a conference in San Diego. The U.S. healthcare system is like a tribute to a foreign power, but we're doing it to ourselves. The U.S. healthcare system is the most expensive in the world, costing about $1 trillion more per year than the next most expensive system, Switzerland's. That means U.S. households pay an extra $8,000 per year compared to what a Swiss family pays. Case and Deaton view this extra cost as a poll tax, meaning it is levied on every individual regardless of their ability to pay. Most Americans think of a poll tax as money people once had to pay to register to vote, but poll was an archaic German word for head. The idea behind a poll tax is that it falls on every head. Despite paying $8,000 more a year than anyone else, American families do not have better health outcomes. Life expectancy in the United States is lower than in Europe. We can brag we have the most expensive health care. We can also now brag that it delivers the worst health of any rich country. Case and Deaton, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, made their critical remarks about U.S. health care during a talk at the American Economic Association's annual meeting, where thousands of economists gathered to discuss the health of the U.S. economy and their latest research on what's working and what's not. The two economists have risen to prominence in recent years for their work on America's, quote, deaths of despair. They discovered Americans between the ages of 25 and 64 have been committing suicide, overdosing on opioids, or dying from alcohol-related problems like liver disease at skyrocketing rates since 2000. These deaths of despair have been especially large among white Americans without college degrees as job options have rapidly declined for them. Their forthcoming book, Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism, includes a scathing chapter examining how the U.S. healthcare system has played a key role in these deaths. The authors call out pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, device manufacturers, and doctors for their roles in driving up costs and creating an opioid epidemic. In the research looking at the taxing nature of the U.S. healthcare system compared with others, Deaton is especially critical of U.S. doctors, pointing out that 16% of people in the top 1% of income earners are physicians, according to research by Williams College professor John Bakaji and others. We have half as many physicians per head as most European countries, yet they get paid 2 times as much on average, Deaton said in an interview. Physicians are a giant rent-seeking conspiracy that's taking money away from the rest of us, and yet everybody loves physicians. You can't touch them. After looking at other health systems around the world that deliver better health outcomes, the academics say it's clear that 2 things need to happen in the United States. Everyone needs to be in the health system, via insurance or a government-run system like Medicare for All, and there must be cost controls, including price caps on drugs and government decisions not to cover some procedures.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure health care for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay. There's more than one way that the healthcare system kills people. This from Science Daily. Nurses get under 7 hours of sleep before a work shift, 83 minutes fewer than days off. Nurses sleep nearly an hour and a half less before work days compared to days off, which hurts patient care and safety, finds a new study by researchers at NYU Rory Myers College of Nursing. The findings are published in Sleep Health, the Journal of the National Sleep Foundation. Nurses are sleeping, on average, less than recommended amounts prior to work, which may have an impact on their health and performance on the job, said Amy Witkowski-Stempfel, PhD RN, Associate Professor at NYU Rory Myers College of Nursing. Nursing, especially in hospitals, is dominated by shift work, with nurses working outside of traditional 9-to-5 day in order to be at the bedside around the clock. Research shows that shift work takes a toll on circadian rhythms and can impair the performance of workers. In addition, 12-hour shifts are common and often result in unexpected overtime to finish patient care tasks or charting. Taken together with commute times and domestic responsibilities, nurses often have limited time to sleep before or between shifts. Sleep deprivation hurts workers' ability to handle complex and stressful tasks, and work-related sleep loss has led to serious errors in other industries, with the nuclear meltdown at Chernobyl as a particularly devastating example. In healthcare, fatigue nurses may be at risk for making critical mistakes in administering medication or making clinical decisions. In addition, getting less sleep was associated with lower measures of patient safety and quality of care, a finding that may indicate several underlying issues. Can nurses catch up on sleep between shifts? Witkowski-Stempfel says it is unlikely. Research on chronic partial sleep deprivation in healthy adults shows that after several days of not getting enough sleep, more than one day of recovery sleep, or more than 10 hours in bed, may be needed to return to baseline functioning. But considering a nurse's schedule, which often involves consecutive 12-hour shifts and may only offer 1 or 2 days off between shifts, the risk of complete recovery or catching up is low. The researchers note that more research on nurses' sleep is needed, but in the interim, healthcare leaders can use evidence-based scheduling strategies, limit the use of overtime, and provide professional development on the importance of sleep for nurses. It is in everyone's interest to have nurses well-rested so they can perform their critical function within the healthcare system and keep patients safe. I'd also add that it's a huge drain on the health of the nurses themselves. Okay, and sticking with that theme still with stat news, healthcare providers are unrecognized victims of mass killings. We're doing little to support them. Even though doctors are exposed to death on a daily basis, moments like these change us. It is our job to save lives, to tell families their kids have died, to manage the resulting long-term medical conditions, and always we wish we could have done more. Whether we're in the hospital or watching events unfold in our homes, it impacts us. Across all fields of medicine, nearly 15% of physicians experience post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, with 40% of trauma surgeons exhibiting the symptoms. In a study of doctors who had treated bomb victims, 1 in 4 were diagnosed with PTSD. What's more, this trauma is felt by people working in an industry with the highest level of depression in the nation. For providers, this pain may manifest as burnout. In nursing, it's called compassion fatigue. Among first responders and mental health professionals, we hear of vicarious and secondary trauma. And for everyone, there's PTSD. There's no question that these are distinct and multifactorial diagnoses. Taken in aggregate, however, they represent a workforce that is suffering. As one emergency room physician told me, practicing medicine these days feels a lot more like triaging on a battlefield than treating in an exam room. It is an apt comparison. Military medics respond to injuries at rates 10 to 100 times higher than clinicians in typical hospitals. But following a mass casualty, these scenes look far more alike than different. In fact, the medical community is increasingly seeking insight from its military counterparts, with the National Academy of Sciences calling for better translation of wartime lessons into domestic protocols. As Colonel Todd Rasmussen, a doctor who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan wars, has written, "The only beneficiary of war is medicine." that modern-day medicine in the U.S. is analogous to war should make us uncomfortable, yet here we are, demanding that our providers learn to be better soldiers. Mass casualty events leave deep and painful scars. They also have the power to bring people together. As we support healthcare teams in the aftermath of tragedy, we need to be using their powerful firsthand experiences to shape a national conversation on the policies that have led to the rise of violence and access to means to inflict that violence. Clinicians may be doing all they can for their patients, but it's time that the public does more for its healers. Okay, I want to end on some good news here with a couple articles. First up, from Stat News here, U.S. cancer death rates drop by largest annual margin ever, report says. Researchers reported the largest ever one-year decline in the U.S. cancer death rate, a drop they credited to advances in lung tumor treatments. The overall cancer rate has been falling about 1.5% a year since 1991. It fell 2.2% from 2016 to 2017, according to a new American Cancer Society report. That's the largest drop ever seen in national cancer statistics going back to 1930, said Rebecca Siegel, the lead author. It's absolutely driven by lung cancer, which accounts for about a quarter of all cancer deaths, she said. Taking lung cancer out of the mix and the 2017 rate drop is 1.4% rather than 2.2%, she added. Most lung cancer cases are tied to smoking, and decades of declining smoking rates led to falling rates of lung cancer illnesses and deaths. But the drops in deaths seems to have been accelerated by recent lung cancer treatment advances. Experts mainly credit advances in treatment. Topping the list are refinements in surgery, better diagnostic scanning, and more precise use of radiation. They also celebrate the impact of newer drugs. Genetic testing can now identify specific cancer cell mutations, which allow more targeted therapy using newer pharmaceuticals that are a step beyond traditional chemotherapy. Even patients with late-stage cancer are surviving for several years, rather than months, after treatment starts. That was very, very uncommon a decade ago. New immunotherapy drugs could accelerate the death rate decline. Cancer Society researchers also found the overall cancer death rate fell by nearly 30% from 1991 through 2017. Death rates from one type of skin cancer dropped even more dramatically than lung cancer, falling 7% a year recently. That decline in melanoma patients is attributed to drugs that came on the market about 9 years ago. Declines in the death rates from prostate, breast, and colon cancer are slowing for a range of reasons. The rising liver cancer death rate seems to have leveled off somewhat. That may be related to better treatment of hepatitis C infections, which are tied to about 25% of liver cancer cases. Okay, and last up, from Yale University, Eco-psychology, how immersion in nature benefits your health. How long does it take to get a dose of nature high enough to make people say they feel healthy and have a strong sense of well-being? In a study of 20,000 people, a team led by Matthew White of the European Center for Environment and Human Health at the University of Exeter found that people who spent 2 hours a week in green spaces, that is, local parks or other natural environments, either all at once or spaced over several visits, were substantially more likely to report good health and psychological well-being than those who don't. 2 hours was a hard boundary. The study showed there were no benefits for people who didn't meet that threshold. The effects were robust, cutting across different occupations, ethnic groups, people from rich and poor areas, and people with chronic illnesses and disabilities. It's well known that getting outdoors in nature can be good for people's health and well-being. But until now, we've not been able to say how much is enough. 2 hours a week is hopefully a realistic target for many people, especially given that it can be spread over an entire week to get the benefit. The study by White and his colleagues is only the latest in a rapidly expanding area of research that finds nature has robust effects on people's health, physically, mentally, and emotionally. Studies have shown that time in nature, as long as people feel safe, is an antidote for stress. It can lower blood pressure and stress hormone levels, reduce nervous system arousal, enhance immune system function, increase self-esteem, reduce anxiety, and improve mood. Attention deficit disorder and aggression lessen in natural environments, which also helps speed the rate of healing. In a recent study, psychiatric unit researchers found that being in nature reduced feelings of isolation, promoted calm, and lifted mood among patients. The growing body of research, combined with an intuitive understanding that nature is vital and increased concerns about the exploding use of smartphones and other forms of technology, has led to a tipping point at which health experts, researchers, and government officials are now proposing widespread changes aimed at bringing nature into people's everyday lives. For example, researchers and policymakers now talk about park deserts in urban areas. Cities are adding or enhancing parks, and schools and other institutions are being designed with large windows and access to trees and green space, or blue space, as in aquatic environments. Peter Kahn, a professor of psychology at the University of Washington, who has worked on these issues for decades, is encouraged by the new focus on the subject, but concerned that the growing interest is more contact with nature relies too much on only experiencing it visually. That's important, but an impoverished view of what it means to interact with the natural world, he said. We need to deepen the forms of interaction with nature and make it more immersive. What are the active ingredients in a dose of nature? Pioneers in this work, Rachel and Stephen Kaplan, who began studying the subject in the 70s, devised attention restoration theory, which holds that paying attention in bustling cities, at work, or in other stressful environments requires a good deal of effortful attention. In a natural environment, however, the Kaplans found that people paid attention more broadly in a less effortful way, which leads to a far more relaxed body and mind. Japanese researchers have studied forest bathing, a poetic name for walking in the woods. They suspect aerosols from the forest inhaled during a walk are behind elevated levels of natural killer, or NK cells, in the immune system, which fight tumors and infections. A subsequent study in which essential oils from cedars were emitted in a hotel room where people slept also caused a significant spike in NK cells. We have entered the urban century, with two-thirds of humanity projected to be living in cities by 2050, said Gretchen Daly, director of the Natural Capital Project at Stanford University and a senior author of a recent paper arguing that the cognitive and emotional benefits of nature should be factored into economic ecosystem service models. There is an awakening underway today to many of the values of nature and the risks and costs of its loss. This new work can help inform investments in livability and sustainability of the world's cities. Understanding nature's therapeutic effects may be arriving at a propitious moment. Some studies have found that anxiety over climate change is a growing phenomenon. Ironically, one of the best antidotes for that might be a dose of green space. If I'm feeling depressed and anxious and worried about the environment, Weber said, then one of the best things I can do is go out in nature. There's a prescription for health for you. Okay, that does it for my show today. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, toppun.com. If you'd like to re-listen to this show or queue up future shows or listen to past shows, feel free to go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.